20-1861 from the District of South Dakota, United States versus Eli Erickson.
There's Mr. Cook, Mr. Rush. Very good. Mr. Rush?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Everybody pinned here? Please proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Judges, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address this through oral argument and provide some additional information that may help when you are reading the briefs, which I believe are well briefed. Mr. Erickson was charged with conspiracy on November 14th, 2018. He had four continuances, and myself and opposing counsel were in our last day of trial on the Marcus Smith case when I was asked if I could do a trial in 10 days. Mr. Erickson's prior attorney was unavailable medically for the next 30 days, and I agreed to take that trial, and myself and Mr. Cook agreed to work fervently in getting the discovery to get to trial, which was 10 days later, but it was actually one work week later. Mr. Erickson would not sign an additional continuance as he had four, and his last continuance that was filed was alleged to him to be forged, and a review of the jail records would appear to indicate that he had not met with anybody to sign that, so he was insistent on going to trial. We proceeded to trial on November 5th of 2019, and the primary witness was a lady by the name of Marcita Connors. Ms. Connors was sentenced during our trial in a separate hearing to 300 months and was cooperating and was the primary witness of the conspiracy. The difficulty arose after the trial in the fact that opposing counsel realized that there were two audio recordings of the debriefs of Ms. Connors. I received those about 2 weeks after the trial, and I filed a motion for a judgment of acquittal, noting that we had received these and they were substantially different than the summaries that we had been provided. Those differences are outlined in the brief. One of the biggest difficulties was, in fact, that Ms. Connors, four debriefs were extremely inconsistent, and the debriefs that I received by audio were an hour and 21 minutes and 45 minutes long. The summaries that were provided to us were extremely pro-prosecution and left out most of the important details. And the judge ruled that we hadn't met the burden for a new trial. While preparing for sentencing, I began to believe that my contact with my client was being monitored by law enforcement. And so I met with my client on February 5th of 2019 in the jail and told him that I would be sending him a fake email. And in that email, I would be indicating to him that I'd actually found the additional audio recording.
Counsel, this is all in the briefs, and you haven't argued government or prosecutorial misconduct. Let's get to the issues that are legal issues briefed.
We believe that the additional information that was provided in the last email or in the last audio recording provides a sufficient basis for Mr. Erickson to get a new trial. The fact of the matter is that there's a culmination. We have the issue of the unprovided for, and let me first say that I don't believe there was misconduct on the part of Mr. Cook. He provided those. He had inadvertently didn't provide the first two. On the third one, it was clear that law enforcement, after the trial, was monitoring my conversations.
You haven't made a young blood argument, so let's move on.
Okay. Basically, my client wasn't provided an opportunity to effectively cross-examine the witness, and that's why he asked for that. On the second issue of the jury,
let me jump to the, seems to me what's pretty important here. In our Meeks decision, we said in order to meet the materiality requirement, newly discovered evidence must be more than merely impeaching. And what are the inconsistencies? All you've argued is we could have cross-examined more effectively, don't you? I think you have. Our case law requires some exculpatory new evidence in order to get it to meet the new trial's high bar.
Correct. And Ms. Connors, in her testimony in court, never once mentioned any of her relatives. During her debrief, she blamed a lot or attributed a lot of her drug dealing to her relatives, but those didn't end up in the report. And at trial, she didn't mention those. When we received the things, it wasn't just impeachment, it was completely and totally different testimony.
It's got to be exculpatory as to Mr. Erickson.
Correct.
The fact that there were 80 instead of 3 co-conspirators doesn't make any difference. If there's nothing removing Mr. Erickson as a conspirator, that's my problem.
What does remove him is in the interviews, she indicates that her drug dealing was with her relatives and not with Mr. Erickson in several occasions that lead to the
combination. Exclusively? Or just on several occasions?
On several occasions, but we were
How does that affect the jury's? How is that likely to have affected the jury's verdict? As to credibility.
It affects he was charged with a 500 gram conspiracy, and if you remove those, transactions, you remove the total amount of drugs that's required as an element of the offense.
And what does that affect?
He wouldn't be guilty of a 500 gram conspiracy if he didn't move 500 grams.
But how would that affect the sentence? No.
That would affect.
Not if the finding was made by a preponderance at sentencing.
Correct, but the one of the elements that the jury needed to properly consider was the total weight of the conspiracy. Additionally, the conspiracy is an agreement. And when you have a witness testifying that her agreement was with her family members and not with my client, that to me is extremely exculpatory. The fact of the matter is that all of the testimony appears to agree that my client did not have an agreement with Marcita Connors. And the evidence of that is that he had nothing. He had not a dime, not a car, nothing, absolutely nothing. And the explanation that she was dealing through her relatives.
But if she's also dealing with Erickson and she's dealing with, she's a distributor dealing with multiple sub-distributors. How does that affect the likelihood I don't understand how it's exculpatory as to the conspiracy issue.
If you testify that my client distributed the drugs, but it was actually your aunt, first of all, she has incredible credibility problems. She didn't testify to that during the trial at all. It leads to the belief that the conspiracy was with her aunt and not with my client. That's incredibly exculpatory information, in my opinion. Additionally, we had very little ability to her testimony was wandering and meandering. And without the audio recordings, many of these recordings happened right as she was picked up. You don't get the information on what she sounded like. I believe that in the first recording, she was actually picked up while she was high. And that leads to a lot of credibility issues there.
Counsel, is it 2 of the 3 recordings were noted in the summary you got? That the summary said there is a recording on 2 of the 3, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But when we suspected, or I knew that there was actually 4 recordings. We just couldn't prove it until I sent this fake email. And then law enforcement, who was watching my emails, read my email and then contacted the prosecutor and said, oh, yeah. And the only time they came forward with that was when I said, hey, I found and I've got a copy of this recording. And that's when they came forward and said to Mr. Cook, oh, by the way, we have this recording. So, I mean, we knew of it from other people in the jail. We knew it existed. We just couldn't prove it. And it's an extremely unusual case when somebody is monitoring conversations with counsel post-trial. So there was, I mean, some very interesting things. What I think is most important in this case may be the jury issue, though, and I'd like to go to that for a second.
Can I ask you, just out of the gate, with since you don't have a whole lot of time, what are you seeking? What relief are you seeking as a result of what you're saying is, you're saying a motion for new trial, but are you asserting that there should have been a different or additional procedure to ensure a fair cross-section in the jury? Or are you just asking a motion for a new trial based on a change of venue to someplace new? What's the basis of your motion?
I did three trials in the course of about 3 months in this district with the same jury panel. And what I became aware of was that you couldn't get a fair jury for any of the Native American defendants because they knew the people and knew of the instances. And we were essentially getting the same jurors who had come from towns that had residential addresses, St. Francis, Eagle Butte, but we wouldn't get those from Rosebud, people that required post office boxes because they're not registered voters. And when you're not a registered voter, you're not a juror. So we had a difficult time, and Judge Lang did an amazing job of attempting to keep Native Americans on the jury. And these people were family members. These people, I mean, it was very, very difficult. And I, after three trials, got to the conclusion of that we'll never get a fair trial for my client because it's such an isolated and remote area that everybody knows him. Everybody knows his family. And the process.
What about the other three reservations? I thought there were four within the division.
There is, but essentially Eagle Butte, Rosebud, and Pine Ridge are essentially connected. There's some rural area between those, but there's so much inter-travel between those and people who have family members that live in each reservation. So when we could...
So I kind of want to get to what relief you're seeking, and I understand the issue and I understand the problem, and I agree that Judge Lang did a very thorough job in trying to address the concerns. But what are you seeking? Are you simply seeking a new trial elsewhere because you've conceded or you believe that there's no way to get a fair cross-section in this district?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't think it would change the fundamental problem that we have here based on the rural nature and the fact that in the voir dire of these people, everybody knows everybody and everybody knows what happened.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, the Swain case has a 10% threshold that you probably know about.
Correct.
And here the disparity difference is 7.4, and isn't that a very high hill for you to climb?
It is, but when you combine it with the fact that we can't get a fair jury due to this very unique rural nature and the fact that this is a very small area with large families that are all related, you end up with this kind of unique section where you're never going to be able to get Native Americans in practice on the jury, or extremely rare, or you have to take extreme efforts to do that. And three trials in a row, you get the idea pretty quickly.
Did you file a motion for a change of venue?
I didn't. At the time, on each time that we would get the jury pool, I would see a lot of Native Americans. And then I did do a little motion with the judge afterwards and said, after the voir dire, I said, we can't get a fair trial here. And I didn't know, I guess we don't really know what to do at that point because he was attempting to keep people on. He was doing extraordinary things to keep Native Americans on, but we just couldn't do it. So it isn't exactly a Batson challenge, but we did have a hearing following it afterwards. What is apparent, though, is in reviewing the jurors is that it's only people with residential addresses or people who, prior to the Supreme Court case where they stuck down the motor voter bill, who had been registered with post office boxes. But we just have a very distinct lack of people in these towns that don't have street addresses. And that's very apparent in looking at this. So if you go to the ABA website, and one of the main pages on the ABA website is talking about how the Native American vote is being suppressed. And we had the 2019 Native American Voting Act that got struck down. But there isn't anybody, including the ABA, that doesn't think that this is a serious issue. And if it's a serious issue for registering voters, then it's a serious issue for jurors that needs to be addressed so that he can have a cross-section of his peers. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is Mr. Swalley. Mr. Swalley was called to testify on one of the last days of trial. And he was arrested. He's a homeless meth addict from the same town as my client. He was brought
Counsel,
in.
You have just seconds, so I'll ask you the punchline on that one to give you a chance, which is, boy, competency of witnesses where the judge states on the record the judge's view. Is there a case anywhere that overcomes that?
No, but, you know, fairness is a perception of the public. And when all of these people see a homeless meth addict appear and testify in court, you know, the original case of fairness is from 1679 was where the judge declared the trial to be fair because both sides could talk. You know, fairness is a fundamental thing. And I think if you look at this, it's just simply not fair to allow.
That's good. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Cameron Cook, and I represent the government in this case. I'm here to answer any questions the court has and to explain why the district court got this case right. The first issue I want to address is the debrief or the Marcita Connors audio recording issue. The first thing I would just say on that is that the government disagrees with defense counsel's interpretation of whether the recordings match the written reports they had in discovery. In the government's view, those are substantially similar of the recordings and the reports. The district court reviewed both of those in camera, both the sets of audio recordings and the reports in camera, and it determined there was nothing material in there or anything exculpatory that would likely result in a new trial. Those documents and recordings are in the record, so the court can view that too. I pointed out a few instances in the brief where I think defense gets it wrong, but just starting with that point, that the government does not agree that there is anything of materiality in those recordings that would change the trial. The biggest point about that I want to bring up, which is also in the briefs, is that even if Marcita Connors did not testify, the other evidence, the seven other people who cooperated, put Mr. Erickson's involvement in the conspiracy over 500 grams. Michael Bellium and Jeremiah Swalley themselves put him over 500, and then there were the other witnesses who testified about their personal knowledge of receiving meth from him and buying it from him, all in the same time frame, the conspiracy. And then there are the three different arrests where the defendant was found in possession of firearms and drug paraphernalia. The October 2016 search of his home with voluminous amounts of guns in his room and outside the residence, lots of drug paraphernalia. The June 2018 arrest where another firearm was found, firearms being tools to the drug trade, and then more drug paraphernalia. And then finally in September 2018, when he fled from law enforcement, hid behind a truck, and there was a handgun found in the grill where he was hiding, and then he dropped $280 in the trail from which he was running. So even if there was anything in those recordings that would be anything other than impeachment, the fact is the government's case was very strong, and even if you took Marcita Connors out, a conviction is still likely based on the evidence, and there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to convict on all the counts, even without Marcita Connors' testimony. I want to turn to the Sixth Amendment issue now. The brief addresses it, and Your Honors, you've mentioned it too. The Duren test is not met here. The 7.4% absolute disparity, which is the second element of the Duren test, is almost identical to the Clifford absolute disparity, which was an Eighth Circuit decision from 1981, and that court held that there was not a prima facie case, or there was not unfair and unreasonable representation of the Native American group in the jury veneer. So I think just based on the precedent.
Mr. Cook, I do have a question about that second step, the absolute disparity calculation. You've got the one number being the percentage of the group in the population, general population. Is the second number, is it the percentage of, of folks in that group that were called to this particular veneer, in other words, Mr. Erickson's case, or is it the percentage in the, what I'll call the master wheel?
Your Honor, it's my understanding it's the number of Native Americans from that particular veneer. So this is in the record, the affidavit of the court clerk. I can't remember what document it is. It's in the brief. But so there
right,
are
yeah, and I understand. It's, I'm sorry, I'll just get to, maybe I didn't make my, I didn't pose my question clearly enough. And I understand that in this case, the second number was based on this particular veneer. But it seems like in some of the case law, there's a suggestion that that second number is from a bigger pool, the master wheel of veneers, or even over a 6 month period of time, what's the percentage of folks from that group in that veneer? Can you speak to that?
I cannot, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for that question. I did not. From not in the affidavit filed by the court clerk, I did not see any of that information, so I would just be speculating, so I can't speak on it.
Okay, well, then can I, maybe I need to ask my question even more pointedly. Which one is the right answer? Do you know, do you have a sense in reading the case law whether it should be the number as to this particular veneer or whether it should be the number from 6 months or a big master wheel?
The government's position is that it should be from the particular case because that's his right. I think you ran into almost a standing issue. There wasn't an absolute disparity in his case. It's a personal right to a fair representation of the community in the veneer, and there was a fair representation in this case. So I think it should just be in the specific case is the government's position.
Counselor, are you aware that the Supreme Court in Durham, when they set it out, was careful to use plural words? It says the representation of this group in veneers, plural, from which juries are selected. Now, of course, this is the middle prong. I get that. But what do you, and then they talk about the jury selection process. Again, this is Durham, Missouri. Some cases just say generally potential jurors looking at all these cases. So can you really tell from the case law?
Your Honor, I admit it. I missed that plural note. That's a good catch. So I'm not sure on the answer to that. I have to go read
Thank
that
you.
Case.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
But Your Honor, even if, again, if there is more evidence out there of it, I don't think you can say that this is a systemic problem with the jury selection process. This court has approved South Dakota's plan for choosing potential jurors. It's racially neutral. It embodies the values of selecting from fair and representative parts of the community. So even if there is a higher number out there for the absolute disparity, if you include the broader set of all veneers, I still don't think the third element of the Durham test is met. And finally, on this topic, Your Honor, is just the comment that the court has already mentioned. There are four distinct reservations in the district in the central division of the District of South Dakota. This case involved almost entirely facts and individuals on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation. There are three others to draw from. The government's position is that if there was such notoriety on the Rosebud Reservation to have stopped anyone from that reservation to be on it, defense could have moved for a change of venue, but he was adamant on having a trial on that specific date, and so we went ahead. So I don't think it was not an error to...
Let me ask you about the motion for change of venue. Are you saying that there was no such request?
No such request or motion was made by the defense. And I think that would be the proper remedy if you're concerned about your reputation, which seems to be the gist of what defense is arguing.
Has that, in your experience or your office's experience, has that been a procedure by which some defendants have sought, a more diverse jury? Has that been done?
In my 2.5 years with the U.S. Attorney's Office, I have not seen that made anywhere in the district. But I just think it is a potential remedy. And I also haven't seen this exact issue before. But I do think that is an option if he thought that his reputation was so bad that he had to get a new venue to draw Native American individuals. Finally, just on Swalley, I think the Jeremiah Swalley issue, the core competency is within the trial court's discretion. And credibility is left to the jury. The one point I would add that wasn't touched on was that defense got to ask Mr. Swally whether he would take a urinalysis that day, and Mr. Swally said no. So even despite the judge's well-reasoned determination that Mr. Swally was competent to testify, defense still got the benefit of impeaching Mr. Swally's credibility. Mr. Swally was testifying about events in 2015 and whether or not he had taken or used methamphetamine around that day in 2019 was irrelevant except for possible impeachment to affect his recollection of events back in 2015. So the jury was able to assess his credibility, and indeed defense got to impeach him with that question it was allowed to ask. Your honors, unless the court has any other questions, the government would cede its time and just ask the court to affirm the verdict in all respects based on the briefs and the arguments today.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Cook. Let's see, Mr. Gust, have you got some time? I think we understand the issues, and the case has been well briefed and argued, and we will take it under advisement.